All right, good evening. Good evening, everybody. Can everybody hear me? First things first. Can everybody hear me? They set up a microphone. Unfortunately, it doesn't really do so well up there. I mean, as much as I move around, for those people that know me when I talk, I will fall off very, very, very fast off of that podium. So it's much better I'm right down here. So tonight is a bit of a difficult thing to talk about. Oh, those are not the sources. Don't worry. There's sources. If you need sources, there's sources on the Bima, on a shtender in the back, and right next to Tzedakah. What's interesting about these sources, which are different than any other sources I've ever done before, there's not one word of Torah on any of these things. So if you want to throw them out, you want to paper airplanes out of them, you can do whatever you want with them at the end of class. Not in the middle, please. So, man. Everyone can hear, right? Even in the back. So yeah, there's like a sickness going around Boca right now. My students, like half of them showed up to school today. The other ones are sick in bed. So Bezrat Hashem, I know that it's going to hit me eventually. My daughter came back from daycare. Oh my, it did not look good. So Bezrat Hashem, I'll try to go as much as I could tonight, please God. And hopefully we'll learn a little bit. Tonight is a very, very difficult topic. There was a great, great rabbi. His name was Rav David Tevel. And what happened was is that he was actually one of the rabbis who was asked to adjudicate a fight in Volozhin Yeshiva. There was a big, big fight in Volozhin Yeshiva. Who was going to be the next Rosh Yeshiva? Was it going to be the Beit HaLevi? Rav Yosef Dov. Wow, I can't believe it. That's embarrassing. Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the very first one, Rav Soloveitchik's great-grandfather. Or was it going to be in the Netziv? So Rav David Tevel supposedly said, and it's recorded in the Torah Temima, in a sefer of his, which is called Makor Baruch, in the first volume, he writes something amazing over there. He says that Rav David Tevel said, in a case like this, it's so hard, because when I'm learning, for example, the Torah, I see, for example, you have cases where you have Esav versus Yaakov. It's very easy to choose. It's very easy to choose between Yitzchak and between Ishmael. That's very easy to choose. In our particular case tonight, it's very similar to what David Tevel said. It's like Yosef and his brothers. This is so, so difficult. We're talking about two of the biggest, biggest rabbis that ever were part of our Mesorah. So tonight's going to be very, very difficult, mainly based on what they write. So tonight, any sort of missives or any sort of issues that you have with how I'm going to refer to stuff, it's, you know, none of it in the slightest comes from me in the slightest. So on Thursday, February 4th, 1751, Rav Yaakov Emden, one of the most prominent rabbis of the 18th century, got up in his private minyan. He was able to have a private minyan in the town of Altona, and announced that a kameya, an amulet, written, and he didn't say at the time who wrote it, but he said this amulet was written by someone who was 100% Sabbathian, 100% a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, what should really rock us so much is that what year is this? 1751. What year did Shabtai Tzvi die? He died in 1676. 100 years before Rav Yaakov Emden is going to die, 1776. This declaration by Rav Yaakov Emden shook the rabbinic world. It changed everything. There is no other thing within the last 300 years that even comes close in comparison to this particular issue. So tonight we're going to see exactly what was going on between Rav Yaakov Emden and between Rav Yosef and Eibeshitz, and what caused this tremendous, tremendous, I will say, Chilul Hashem. And this was the last vestige of any sort of rabbinic prestige. This was the last. It never exists after this time. There's actually a book which is written by Rav Shalom Hammer. Rav Shalom Hammer, he's a rabbi in Eretz Yisrael. He works for an organization that brings Torah to people who are people in the army who don't have Torah, who don't know anything about Torah. So he's a Talmud of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. So he has a beautiful, beautiful Haggadah all about Rav Yosef and Eibeshitz. So I remember I was working at the Sfarim Sale in YU. I mean, I was like trying to get married. That's like the way you get married. You work at the Sfarim Sale. But for me, I unfortunately have an addiction, as my wife will tell you, I have an addiction to books. So instead of paying attention to the girls, I was paying attention more to the books. So I open up, not a bad thing, I open up the book, and in this Haggadah, yes, in this Haggadah, oh, sorry, I thought you were referring to me, sorry. In this Haggadah, there's an introduction. And in the introduction, it says something fascinating. something absolutely fascinating. It's a whole foreword by Rav Berelwein. And Rav Berelwein has a statement that has stayed with me ever since that time in 2005 when I happened to chance upon the Sefer. He says that this argument between Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz and Rav Yaakov Emden right now is only relegated to scholarship. Because in the Beit Midrash, we know there was never ever a machloket. In the Beit Midrash, that has already been put totally to bed. There's no question at all. Rav Yosef Eibeshitz was not a Sabbathian. He was not a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. That's what he wrote over there. What's so interesting is that there's a wide array of very, very, very amazing people who I look up to, who have a tremendous amount of Yirat Shemayim, who don't say that it has been put to bed, who don't say that in the slightest. I'll just mention two scholars who are known to be two of the biggest Sabbathian scholars in the entire world. One of them is someone who actually used to come down to our community. He should come down more often, Bezrat Hashem. His name is Dr. Schneier Lyman. He is absolutely incredible. My wife and I, when we got married, we used to go every single month. He has a special shiur in his house, all about stuff that he does in Queens and Kew Garden Hills. Every single Shabbat, we used to spend over there whenever he would give the shiur, and we would sit and listen to Dr. Lyman. I could just listen to him read the phone book. And sometimes he was basically reading, like he found Volozhin. He found the roster of students in Volozhin. And he's reading the names, and it's so interesting, it's so amazing. In the 1850s, they even had a student from Chicago. I'm sorry, I just get very excited about this. So Dr. Lyman, he's one of the people that we're going to quote over here quite a lot. The other person is a professor at Yeshiva University. His name is Rabbi J.J. Schachter, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter, who's tremendous. His father was Rabbi Herschel Schachter, not Rosh Yeshiva of YU, but from the Bronx, who was a tremendous tzaddik, really, really good in the American Army. Really, he was a chaplain, did amazing, amazing stuff. So J.J. Schachter actually decided to translate a sefer, and he got halfway through it, and he stopped. What sefer am I referring to? Rav Yaakov Emden wrote what is in Jewish history extremely, extremely rare. Gedolim, big rabbis, don't write autobiographies. They just don't. Part of it is that big rabbis, they're not supposed to be so self-aware to write down their own feelings. They're not supposed to write about their own occurrences because they should be busy learning Torah. Here we have a very, very, very interesting thing. The only other rabbinic autobiography that I know about is from the Aderet. The Aderet was Rav Kook's father-in-law. He writes also a wonderful autobiography, which is really, really interesting and teaches us a lot about what it was like being in the rabbinate during the 19th century. But Rav Yaakov Emden wrote a sefer called Megillah Sefer. And there's been many different editions. In fact, there's even an English edition that you can find on Amazon. Don't buy it. It's really, really badly done. Really badly done. And he is, if anything, unstintingly honest about every single thing. Every single thing. Just to give a small view. And this is what he himself writes. He says, although he loved his father tremendously, and he did, his father was the great rabbi, the Chacham Tzvi, who was the rabbi, this will be very important, in Altena, before Rav Yosef Eibeshitz, about 50 years before Rav Yosef Eibeshitz. He was also a rabbi in Amsterdam. He mentions that he one time went over to London and he sees the picture of the Chacham Tzvi that's in some art gallery in London, and he says he began to cry because it looked exactly like his father. So he writes so beautifully about his father, but he also says that his first marriage at the age of 17 was foisted upon him by his father. There was another girl who he loved tremendously, who had all of the ma'alot, who was a fantastic, fantastic girl. Very, very matim for him. Very, very appropriate for him. Yet his father said she is not miyuchas enough. She does not have enough of a lineage. So he discouraged that wedding, and that actually ended up causing a tremendous, tremendous rift in his own life. And he ends up, his first wife passes away, he gets married a second time, that second wife passes away, and he gets married a third time. All three marriages, the last marriage was a little bit better. Part of it might have been because it was his niece, so, in the family. But the first two marriages of his were very, very, very unhappy. So why am I talking about this? Because he happens to have a lot of interesting stuff in there. He's ridiculously honest, which means that when he writes something, I would venture to say he's telling you exactly how it is. Because what he talks about in this book, and I don't want to go too much about it, I highly suggest looking at it, in the Hebrew edition, I highly suggest looking at it. It's very, very interesting because he's so, so honest. Now, why am I talking about this? Because J.J. Schachter wrote, he was writing a scholarly edition, an English edition of Megillah Sefer, but he stopped in the middle because he said, I really can't bring this to English press. I can't have people thinking so badly about a certain Gadol. Even though he wrote it, let's keep it inaccessible, let's keep it in its Hebrew. So it's very interesting that this great, great rabbi, Rabbi Yosef Naibishitz, that there's even anything negative about him. Just to give you a very, very small idea, this over here happens to be one of his svarim. It's called the Kretiu Plesi. Kretiu Plesi. It is known to be, if anyone wants to learn Yoredeya, you must learn the Kretiu Plesi. If you want to learn Choshen Mishpat, you have to learn his Sefer, the Urim V'Tumim. He is known to be, without a doubt, one of the greatest rabbis of all time. Absolutely, one of the greatest rabbis of all time. In fact, just a few years ago, they published Chidushei Rav Yonasan, Rav Yonasan Aibishitz on Masechet Brachot. As you see over here, very, 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 very beautiful, beautiful Chidushim on the Torah. Also, I have this edition. It's called Yari Im Divshi. It's different talks which are based on the Yarot Dvash. And there's a rabbi, Rabbi Shalom Hammer, who I just mentioned before, who from Maggid Press just published in English 9 different addresses by Rav Yosef Naibishitz, which is all based on his homiletics, which is called Yarot Dvash. So, we're talking about someone who is very prolific. He wrote 119 Svarim. So much so, and he was such an amazing person, that Rav Eliezer Menachem Man Shach, Rav Shach, the Rosh Yeshiva of Panovich, used to say about himself, he said, I don't need to learn any Musar Sfarim. All I have to do is learn this Sefer, and it gets me right back to learning. Because of the towering intellect that Rav Yosef Naibishitz was able to bring over here, that's how important he was. So, how exactly does this happen? Not to mention one other source, just to tell you who Rav Yonasan was, especially in connection to Rav Yaakov Emdin. Rav Schachter, Rosh Yeshiva YU, when he talks about this particular fight, what he says is that we're talking about the Moshe Rabbeinu of the generation. We're talking about Rav Yosef Naibishitz, who raised over 20,000 students, was one of the biggest rabbis in all of Europe, if not the biggest rabbi, in a time, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, when we're the Vilna Gaon, the Pnei Yehoshua, the Nabi Yehuda, the Chidah, and if you want to talk about the secular world, Voltaire, or obviously here in America, and this is obviously the first time I ever brought this book over here, all of our founding fathers. We're talking about a time of very prodigious intellect. We're talking about a time where people were so, so into Haskalah, so much into this enlightenment thought, that in a time where you have all these great, great people, he towered above all of them. So how exactly does he get mixed into this entire thing? So many of the texts that we're using, I just wanted to show you guys one, and I can email it to anybody if they want. There's an amazing, amazing, amazing essay, really great essay, by a researcher named Pavel Masheko. And he writes about how this changed Judaism tremendously in terms of the press. And that's exactly what you guys have in front of you in terms of the text, but we'll get to that in just a little bit. There are other articles written by Dr. Lyman, and a lot of very, very interesting ideas. So let us begin talking about Shabtai Tzvi. First things first, who was Shabtai Tzvi? So we all know Shabtai Tzvi was the Messianic pretender, but let's go a little bit more into his history. Shabtai Tzvi was born in Izmir, in 1726. And he was born on Tisha B'Av. And that year, Tisha B'Av happened to fall out on Shabbat. So the custom used to be that if you have a baby born on Shabbat, you name the baby Shabtai. That's the name of the baby. So that's how he became Shabtai Tzvi. Where did his family come from? I one time took a course in Yeshiva University, and what happened was is that there's this amazing book written by a professor from Hebrew University, Gershom Shalom. He passed away in 1980. He happens to be the expert in Shabtai Tzvi. This is a, I don't know how many pages. This is a, I don't know, 900-page biography of Shabtai Tzvi. I've been through it 5 times. I love it. This is a new edition. I personally, this is like totally on my alley. I love it. So I was taking this course in Yeshiva University, and what happened was that the professor happened to say, Shabtai Tzvi was Sephardi. Oh my. As a smarty person, oh my. I don't want Shabtai Tzvi to be smarty. Not at all. I really, really, really don't want him. So I actually raised my hand and I said, I'm sorry, you know, Bimchila Kvodo, I have to tell you, there's a whole discussion. He was actually Ashkenazi, and if he wasn't Ashkenazi, he was part of the special group of Romaniot who came from Rome. He was definitely, definitely, definitely not smarty. So he's like, oh, very interesting. So at the end of the year, what happened was, is that even though I got an A's on everything, at the very end, I see B+. I was told later on, never, ever, ever go ahead and go against the professor. And I never took him again. That's bad as a teacher and bad as bad for everything. There's another amazing, amazing book that I just bought. I know every book is amazing. Not every book. We'll discuss some books that are not so amazing. Like that translation of Megillah Sefer. This book just came out this past year. It's called The Burden of Silence, written by a fellow named Sengad Sisman. This, I don't know, my wife got very upset at me because these academic books are very, very expensive, but I didn't care when I heard about this. It's an entire history of the Dun Meh. The Dun Meh. The Dun Meh, as we're going to discuss in just a little bit, a secret group of crypto-Jews, to a certain degree, who lived outwardly as Muslims. There were 14,000 Dun Meh in Salonika in World War I. Every single year on Tisha B'Av, they used to go out to the sea waiting for Shabtai Tzvi to come back. And in fact, and I heard this from Dr. Lyman, there's even a group of Dun Meh currently living in Washington, D.C., who still believe, listen, Minag Avoseichem B'Yadeichem, they believe that Shabtai Tzvi, who passed away once again in 1676, was Mashiach and is Mashiach. Very interesting. And we'll discuss in terms of what exactly that means, because there's a lot to talk about. So, he was born on Tisha B'Av. Why is that important? So there's a very famous Gemara that says, when was Mashiach born? On Tisha B'Av. So already you're starting to see a narrative that's really going to go very, very much downhill. And what happened was, is that his family arrived in the Ottoman Empire based on many, many different factors. Before the 17th century, Jews had gotten tremendously wealthy living in Svat, living in different areas, for example, living in areas like Aleppo, living in areas like Salonika. And they were very wealthy because they were textile traders. However, what happened was, is that the English Levant Company opened in Istanbul. England started this company, and they were able to provide these textiles for much, much, much cheaper. Much cheaper. What happened was these communities ended up dying. And what happened was, where exactly were these people going to go? They decided to come to the Ottoman Empire, which obviously Istanbul was part of it, but they decided to come specifically to Izmir. Izmir started off as not such a big town. It eventually became the biggest trading area of, one of the biggest trading areas of the 18th century. So what happened was a wave of Ashkenazi immigrants also came, as we just mentioned. And why did they come? Because the Turks, who were obviously running the Ottoman Empire, they were fighting the Poles. And these fights were very, very brutal, so the Jews wanted to get out of it. So they said, let's move over to the Ottoman Empire. Just as an aside, my own family, which, you know, my last name is Casorla, we know our family left Spain in 1492 or 1390. There's actually a whole machloket about that in my family. They eventually ended up under the Ottoman Empire, in Greece, in Salonika, in those areas, in the Balkan areas. So what happened was the Jewish population of Izmir grew and became, at this time, 7,000 Jews, along with 15,000 Greeks and 60,000 Muslims. A very, very important, very, very important port. The Tzvi family, they were recent immigrants to the city, and the father Mordechai, they say he probably came from Greece, but once again, either Ashkenazi or Romaniot. He was definitely, definitely not Sephardi, as I mentioned before. And Shabtai Tzvi was extremely adept at learning, so much so that at the age of 18, he was already given his rabbinical ordination, he was already given smicha. So if you want to talk about a Mashiach who doesn't know things, this is going to be over here a Mashiach that most certainly does understand Torah, which is very, very interesting. Oh. And Jews and Christians and non-Muslims, they were known as dhimmis. Now, if you're living in the Ottoman Empire, if you're living in the Ottoman Empire, what happens is you're under Muslim rule. According to strict Muslim law, us, all of us in this room, all of us Jews, Bezrat Hashem, all of us, we all are something called Ala Katab, which means that we are all people of the book. I know it's called Great Debates, it's not people of the book anymore, but we're called people of the book. We are given certain liberties according to something called the Pact of Omar, which, according to their legend, they say was started by Omar, who happens to be their second big caliph. It's a whole discussion. It really comes way later. And he says something fascinating. The Pact of Omar, it says over there that Jews are unable to go ahead and build new synagogues. They can't build a shul taller than a mosque. Jews can't ride on horses. And other types of stuff. There even became, for the very first time, a Jewish star, and that's a whole different story. Obviously not to the same degree as will be later on, but it was very, very bad. However, there was one out that Jews had that made life in the under Muslim rule really tolerable. What it was called the jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A, and what that was a special tax that Jews paid to the Muslims. It was kind of a protection tax, and as long as they paid that tax, they were basically left unmolested, and they weren't bothered in the slightest. And what happens is that what's interesting is that even though according to the Pact of Omar, you're not allowed to build new synagogues, it's absolutely prohibited. What happened was is that if the rulers were making money, they were more than willing to go ahead and just let it slide. So for example, in Istanbul, in 1453, that's a very important year, 1453, there were only three synagogues in Istanbul. However, in 1753, there were nine synagogues. So you already see they're already building more synagogues. Also, to give you an idea, in Izmir, there were three synagogues. Oh, I messed up. Sorry about that. There were three synagogues in 1453. In 1753, there were 21 synagogues. 21 synagogues. So we see over here that they were not strictly keeping the Pact of Omar, and that was very much on purpose, because as long as they were making the money, they didn't care. In Izmir, it started with three synagogues, and eventually, by the time Shabtai Tzvi, there was nine synagogues in Izmir, which means you see a tremendous amount of growth. By the second half of the 17th century, the Jews began to lose their competitive power, and this is very interesting. Bizayid II, I know we spoke about this previously in a previous shiur, Bizayid II, he did something amazing. When Ferdinand and Isabella basically kicked out the Jews, and when they kicked out the Moors, what happened was Bizayid II, who was the Sultan at the time, he couldn't understand. He said, there's an entire group of productive people who you're kicking out of the land. Why are you doing this? He couldn't believe it. So what did he do? He sent ships to go bring these exiles to Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire. And what happened was, this first wave of Jews helped set them up for a new golden age. And that's exactly what happened. And these Jews were in all positions of power. It was amazing. It was quite amazing. However, what happened was that eventually, with everything that was going on, especially with so many Jews being so far removed from the Spanish Inquisition, what happened was the Jews started becoming more Ottoman. And because Jews became more Ottoman, they started losing those advantages that they had before. Before, what was so great about them is that they could connect with everyone around the world, because they understood Spanish, Ladino obviously, they were able to speak to different people, different traders in Hebrew even, there's even sources like this. However, as time passed on, they ended up losing out, especially with the ascendry of Christian Europe. That with Christian Europe becoming so important, as they're called the Franks. With Christian Europe becoming so important, now what happens is that instead of Jews being the important people that are going to work for your organization, now you're going to hire Greeks. Because these Greeks are Christian, they understand the language much better, and they understand Christianity way, way better. So what's going to happen now to the Jewish monopoly? What's going to happen now to the Jewish, place of power within the Ottoman Empire? It goes totally down. And unfortunately, what happens is now you end up with a tremendously, a lot of poor people, tremendous poverty going on, and hunger, and all sorts of issues. You had a class that was at first very, very high, and now they're very, very low. And you could already see that when things are very, very low, it's very, very, very easy to believe in a false Mashiach. Very easy to believe in this kind of stuff. So what happened was, is that the Ottoman Empire and the Jewish communities were going through much hardships. And young Shabtai was very busy with his own work. According to this work by Gershom Shalom, Shabtai Tzvi was bipolar. Shabtai Tzvi was bipolar. The way that we would say nowadays, you know, you would get the person Depakote or lithium or whatever it is. But bipolar, for those people that don't know, you end up with tremendous, tremendous highs and very, very, very deep, deep lows. And you end up in these manic, depressive episodes. So according to Gershom Shalom says this explains everything about Shabtai Tzvi. Because many, many times, he was incredible. He was able to be so out there and talking to people and hanging out with people and being very, being very charismatic. However, there were other times when he wasn't charismatic at all and he shut himself in. So Kabbalistically, it's very easy to explain that. Kabbalistically, when he's out there, that's one type. That's like the sun shining. However, when he's by himself, if you couch in Kabbalistic terms, that's going to be like the dark side. That's going to be where he's dealing with all sorts of demons. And that's going to be how Nathan of Gaza explained how Shabtai Tzvi went through different cycles. However, it's a bit of a stretch. As more Sabbatean scholarship continues, people are less enamored with this answer of Gershom Shalom. What many people say, and this is true, and this is like a whole question in terms of, is it the symptom, is it the cause, what exactly is going on over here, that by people who are more mystical, it's really, it's really indicative of their personality, that a lot of the times they're very high, and a lot of times they're very low, and that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with bipolar, with mental illness. So you have many professors, for example, there's Yehuda Levis, who lives in Eretz Yisrael, who teaches at Hebrew U. He writes that he does not think that Shabtai Tzvi was bipolar at all. And he also thinks it's inappropriate to look back at people who lived during the 1600s and basically be armchair, you know, psychiatrist and, you know, pharmacologist and try telling them exactly what medicines they should take. That's really, he totally, totally disagrees with that. However, he does some very, very strange things during these dark times. Very strange things. However, Shabtai Tzvi growing up is extremely traditional. He's doing everything totally correct according to this Kabbalistic method. There's one other thing that needs to be said right now, which Gershom Shalom spends a lot of time on. How exactly could you even come up with a type of idea of philosophy where you have someone who's up all the time and down down half the time? How exactly do you come up with this philosophy? I want to discuss that in just a little bit, but just keep in your minds the thought of the Arizal. We've actually spoken about this before. However, we'll discuss a little bit more about this in just a little bit. However, at this time, it's just becoming popularized. The Arizal's ideas, because of the printing press, the Arizal's ideas, which we're going to get way more into, become popularized. So we're going to see that Shabtai Tzvi is very much influenced, and Nathan of Gaza is able to use these explanations of the Arizal to continue his messianic movement, which we'll discuss in just a little bit. So what happens is that Shabtai lived in seclusion. However, he did do, and even at this time, he did do strange things. What sort of strange things? So, for example, he ends up, later on, he ends up marrying a girl. He ends up marrying a girl who's totally, totally inappropriate for him. The term, if you want to look, for example, like in Tanakh, for example, the term is called a pundiki, or as you would say, a zona. He marries a girl of ill repute, and he marries her. And that's very problematic, because how exactly do you have a Messiah that marries someone of such low stature? Another example is that after he gets married to this girl, he ends up also getting married to a Sefer Torah. What on earth does that mean? There's an entire thing that happens. He has a whole ceremony. He gets married to Sefer Torah. And this is even the strangest part. He walks around with a baby carriage. And in the baby carriage is a fish. What on earth does any of this stuff mean? I have no idea. Gershom Shalom discusses what the importance of all of these things are within his book. But tonight I really don't want to get too much into that. So what happened was there was a lot of issues going on within the Ottoman Empire. There was an emperor, his name was Ibrahim, and his nickname was Ibrahim the Mad. Anytime you have a name like Ibrahim the Mad, usually people aren't going to like you. He ends up killing his entire family, but the Janissaries were a group of people that were taken from the Slavic states, who were specifically meant to be the people taking care of the Sultan. They decided to kill him, and they killed Ahmad, and they put instead, Ibrahim, and they put instead Mehmed the Fourth. Mehmed the Fourth, he happened to be at the time, he was 8 years old, and the Janissaries and those people around him took charge. And he will be very, very important because he's going to be the Sultan that Shabtai Tzvi is going to have a connection with. There's another thing going on, and for those people who know Ashkenazic history, this is this is the thing that caused, according to many, many people, this is what caused within Ashkenaz the Sabbatean movement to become so important. And what am I referring to? The Chalniki massacres. The massacres happened between the years of 1594 and 1657. And what happened was my wife, she's tremendous. She understands languages. She gets languages like this. And she learned Russian. So what she did I know it's amazing. She's not Russian. She won like an award from the state of New Jersey. It's amazing. So why am I telling this story? Because what happened was she went to Ukraine 7 different times to do Kiruv. And it's amazing. She did incredible stuff. I know. The story she tells, oh my, about the Soviet era bathrooms, oh my gosh, terrible. So what happens is that when she was in Ukraine, she's walking around and she sees in the town center, what does she see? A ginormous statue of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. It's crazy. And they view him, I mean to us it's crazy, they view him to be their revolutionary, they view him to be their George Washington, and they hold him in such high regard. Like, even to say anything negative about him is terrible. It was very bad, because what happened was, many of those people in Poland, if you were a paritz, that's the term, right? A paritz, and you were in charge of a large tract of land, a lot of the stuff you were doing was that you were growing alcohol. We know this, for example, because we have different tshuvas, for example, of the shach, for example, all about what are you supposed to do in terms of Pesach if you own a lot of chametz. So very interesting. That's where the institution of selling chametz comes from before this period, about 100 years before. So what happens is that many of the paritzes, they said, we're not going to entrust goyim, we're not going to entrust non-Jewish people with our land and with our reserve of alcohol. So they said, who can we trust? So what they did was that they actually elevated Jews into high positions of power. And these paritzes, they treated the peasants terribly. That's the truth. They treated the peasants terribly. And what happened was, when the peasants revolted, who did they take their anger out on? The paritzes and the Jews who were in charge of these lands. So therefore, so many communities were killed during this time. In fact, they say that an estimated 100 to 200,000 people were killed during the Chalniki massacres, which at this time, when you're talking about a world population only in the millions, that's huge, huge. So this is actually also where we get the word pogrom within our lexicon. During this time, that this time of Chalniki, it was absolutely terrible. So this also was the nadir of Judaism at this point. This is such a bad, bad time. Another thing that most people don't talk about, and this I found to be really fascinating, this is brought down in the aforementioned book, The Burden of Silence, which is all about the Dun Mat. They bring down something else that I had never seen before. It turns out that at this time, there was something called the crisis of the 17th century. What was going on? I know it's very similar to maybe what's going on now, but not exactly. There was something called the Little Ice Age. A Little Ice Age. Global temperatures within only a couple centuries went down 4 degrees Celsius, which is a tremendous amount. And what happened was that caused a lot of problems. A lot of problems. So for example, there was flooding. For example, there were storms. For example, there was an inability of growing crops. It was really, really bad. Multiple people starved. And in fact, we even have Edut. We even have testimony from Voltaire about this thing, where he writes that things were so, so bad for them, they barely had any food. Things were really bad. And that's why the Ottomans did something really funny, because it was very, very cold. They made something called, during the 1650s, they made something called a fur tax. Why did they make a fur tax? Because it was so cold, so many people started wearing furs way more than before. So that's another thing. Another thing is 1666, which is coming right up. I mean, right now we're talking about 1648. But 1666, just the number 666, according to Christians, there's a whole idea that they have all about end of times. Really don't want to get into that in the slightest at all, because it really doesn't interest me. So there's a lot of messianic fervor going on. To give a very small idea, in 1648, Menashe ben Yisrael goes over to Oliver Cromwell, and he says, "Oliver Cromwell, 1666 is coming up. Don't you want your Messiah? Don't you want Jesus to come back? The only way Jesus is going to come back is if you open up England to Jews." And this is what he told Oliver Cromwell. Absolutely. And Oliver Cromwell opened up England to Jews for the very first time since, I think, like 1248. It was very, very long time. The last Jewish community, from what I understand, was York, where they took all of the Jews in the 13th century. They took all the Jews in the town of York, they put a chain around the entire shul, and they burned the entire shul down, along with the entire Jewish community of York, and that was the last remnant of Jews in England. So this, right now, you have Menashe ben Yisrael opening up England to the Jews. And you have this messianic fervor because he really thinks that, you know, that Jesus is coming back. Didn't happen and won't ever happen. So let's talk about what was going on in terms of Shabtai Tzvi. So Shabtai Tzvi comes out and says, "I'm Mashiach." Let's talk about some very important things. Number one, there was a huge Jewish community in Amsterdam. And it was a very wealthy community in Amsterdam. And most of them, I shouldn't say most, a lot of them decided to do something very interesting. They said, "Mashiach has come." Shabtai Tzvi announces himself in 1666 as Mashiach. So a lot of them said, "We're moving to Israel right now. I will give you my house for pennies on the dollar, and we'll move to Israel." What happens? Obviously, Shabtai Tzvi is not Mashiach. You have also a line in the Zohar. The Zohar says that neshamot have to come down to the world in order for Mashiach to come, have more and more and more children. So you had at this time, you had many people who never would have gotten married to each other ever before, but they say, "Uh-oh, Mashiach's coming, you better get started," and they end up getting married and doing this thing. There was also a widespread tshuva movement, a huge tshuva movement. A lot of this has to do with many of these Jews who were conversos, many of these Jews from 1492, who pretended to outwardly be Christian, they came back into the fold, many of these people, and they wanted penitence, because Mashiach is coming. So therefore, they also were very, very much into this. And there's this big Baal Tshuva movement going on. So my question to you, do you want to be the rabbi that's going to get in front of this Baal Tshuva movement and say, "You know what? All this Torah learning you're doing? No, thank you. All of this tzedakah you're giving? No, thank you. All of this messianic fervor? No, thank you." So that's why, at the time, very few rabbis, you can count almost on one hand, came out against Shabtai Tzvi. Very few rabbis. In fact, one rabbi was in Amsterdam. His name is Rav Yaakov Sas Portas. He was tremendous. He wrote an entire sefer called Novel Tzvi, Sitzat Novel Tzvi. It happens to be one of the Haftarot, which is all about a withering Tzvi. It's all about a withering Shabtai Tzvi. So he writes against Shabtai Tzvi at the time. Very few rabbis were willing to come out against it. And to give an idea of how persuasive Shabtai Tzvi was, the Taz, who was living in Poland at the time, he says, "Oh my gosh, is this really Mashiach?" So he sends five emissaries, three sons of his and two sons-in-laws. And what happens is they go to Shabtai Tzvi, they talk to him, and they come back to the Taz. And what do they tell the Taz? They say, "This is Mashiach." So you could already see, and they were very scholarly. You could see he was very, very, very charismatic, and to a certain degree he was the real deal, as far as real deal is concerned, in terms of being a big scholar. There were a lot of issues though, a lot of issues, obviously. Which really comes out within the next period. So what happens is that what gave him the imprimatur of kashrus? Like, what gave him his kashrus? What it was, according to many, many people, and this is something that that Gershom Shalom writes, he says his prophet was someone named Nathan of Gaza. He was known to be a miracle worker, whatever that means, obviously living in the Gaza area. And he was someone who was very well respected for his learning. And when he came out, even though he was much younger than Shabtai Tzvi, about half his age, when he came out and said that Shabtai Tzvi is the real deal, that convinced a lot of people. A lot of people, because he was someone who was very well respected. What happens is that the emperor, Mehmet, who we mentioned before, everyone's best friend, Mehmet IV, so he doesn't like any of the stuff going on in his empire. What's happening is, he only just wants the money. That's all he cares about. As long as trade is happening, he doesn't care. So he hears about this Messiah who might come, and at least according to many people, are coming to conquer him, and is going to come and take over the Ottoman Empire. So he brings in Shabtai Tzvi, and he gives Shabtai Tzvi a choice. He says, either you're Mashiach, and therefore, what am I going to do? I'm going to take a sword, and I'm going to cut your head off. And if your head doesn't come off, obviously you're Mashiach. That's one option. The other option he gave him is, or you could convert to Islam. Guess which one Shabtai Tzvi decided to do. He wasn't going to give the first one a try. He decided to convert to Islam. And he ends up converting to Islam and living the last 10 years of his life as a Muslim, living within the palace of Mehmet IV. He was very well respected by Mehmet IV. However, he lives as a Muslim, which is really interesting. So how exactly would you explain that? If you're Nathan of Gaza, how do you explain that? So this is where the thoughts of the Arizal are very important. This is why I mentioned it before. The Arizal has an idea that what we need to do is that we need to even go to places that might not be so kosher and take out something called the Nitzotzot HaKidoshim, to take out the holy sparks. And he has an idea, which is obviously not as far as Shabtai Tzvi is going to take it, but he has an idea that even within sin, there's holiness. Even within sin, there's holiness. So Nathan of Gaza says about Shabtai Tzvi that he had to become Muslim. Because what's he going to do? He's going to become Muslim. He's going to, whatever he's supposed to Kabbalistically do for these hidden sparks that are hidden within Islam, he's going to purify these sparks and then come back as Mashiach. And that's it. And that's why he became Muslim, according to Nathan of Gaza. And many people believe that. Many people didn't want to give it up. Even though most Jews, already by the time he converted to Islam, they said, that's the end of your legitimate career. But many, many Jews continued believing in Shabtai Tzvi. And Shabtai Tzvi ends up dying in 1676 at the age of 50. And Nathan of Gaza ends up dying also a little bit later in 1680. However, after Shabtai Tzvi dies, Nathan of Gaza has to come up also with a philosophy. So what's his philosophy? Once again, this a lot of this has to do with Kabbalah becoming widespread. There's an idea called the Sefirot, which means Hashem has 10 different attributes. 10 different attributes. There's a whole discussion about this, about how that could happen. So what happens is that according to Nathan of Gaza, Shabtai Tzvi had to die in order to join the Godhead, in order to become one of the 10 Sefirot. And once again, many people continued believing in him. Many people continued. So, he travels all over, and he ends up dying in 1680, like we mentioned before. So how exactly would a person observe Sabbatianism? How would a person be a Sabbatean, basically, after 1680? After Nathan of Gaza is gone, and definitely after Shabtai Tzvi is gone. So a few different things you could do. So for example, Avram Peretz, who lived in Salonika, he was a pupil of Natan, of Nathan of Gaza, he said that if you keep the oral law, you're a sinner. If you keep the Torah Shabbat Peh, you're a sinner. So that's obviously very, very extreme. Very extreme. However, it's based to a certain degree, that what happens is, a lot of these ideas, once again, are based on the Arizal. That what needs to happen over here is that you need to go to the depths of impurity in order to take out those sparks and make them holy. For those of us that sounds very, very strange, and it does sound very strange, keep in mind that has moved into legitimate Jewish Mesorah. So for example, there's something called the Tzavat HaBesht, which happens to be the Baal Shem Tov's, it's his last will and testament. So there's a whole question whether or not it's real, whether or not it's not. So he writes something within there that's very interesting. He says if you see a very beautiful woman, he says you shouldn't think, oh no, I shouldn't think about that. He said what you should do is you should transfer it and say, look at that beautiful woman. She's beautiful, but guess who made her? Hashem made her. And therefore she gave you an appreciation of Hashem. So we see over here that these ideas of the Arizal, of stuff that start off as impure, that you make them into something that's more pure, that even is something over here. So there are different gradations of Sabbatianism. So let's first get the bad ones out of the way. The absolute, like, worst ones out of the way, the most extreme. So this entire book is about the Dan Met. The Dan Met took what Shabtai Tzvi did literally. They all converted to Islam. They all converted to Islam, and that's how they followed Shabtai Tzvi. But secretly, they were keeping some forms of Judaism. And as I mentioned before, every Tisha B'Av, they would go out to the sea and wait for Shabtai Tzvi to come back. Really, really interesting. Now, once again, Tisha B'Av is not a sad day. Because remember, the Messianic era has come according to this idea. So the four fasts about the temple, those are no longer sad days. That era is over. So Tisha B'Av was turned into a day of festivities, of eating, of drinking. I hate to say this, but there's a small group of people in Australia, I'm not going to say who what happened was, they believe that their particular rabbi happens to be Mashiach, even though he passed away. And they actually did. Every single Tisha B'Av, they have a Seuda in Australia. They have a Seuda because they say the Messianic era has come, and therefore, you do not have to keep Tisha B'Av. Once again, that's not normative in the slightest. Let's continue going about weird, weird things. There is a biblical, we actually just read about this a couple of parshiot ago, there is a biblical prohibition about eating something called chelev. Chelev are forbidden fats. In order to get out these nitzotzot, in order to get out these sparks of impurity, you would actually have to eat chelev. You need to eat these impure fats, and not only that, you make a bracha. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav sivanu matir Asurim. Matir Asurim, which we say every single morning, which is Hashem, you release the bound. According to them, they changed the beracha. They said, Matir Asurim, that you have made that which is not allowed, now you've made it allowed. Oh my, this is like really uncomfortable for me, but I'll just talk about it because it's in Poskim. It's within Poskim. There was actual wife swapping going on amongst many of these very, very strong Sabbatians, many of these extreme Sabbatians. Actual wife swapping. Why is it in our halachic literature? Because the question is, if a woman is compelled by her husband to go and be mezaneh, to go and have an inappropriate relationship with another man, does that count as forced? Does that count as ones? That's the whole discussion in Poskim, which is very, very interesting. And I'm not going to talk so much about that, because next week Rabbi Blumenthal is going to talk about the Frankists, and the Frankists are really the ones who, you know, they say they kept that mitzvah very, very well. Very well. As we mentioned before, Tisha B'Av was turned into a holiday, and that's the most extreme. What was scary about it, what was most scary about this, is that you could be sitting in shul next to somebody, and the person has a beard, the person has payas, he has a yarmulke on, he's wearing tefillin, he looks totally, totally like you, but yet he is actually a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi, and he's doing all of these antimonian, he's doing all of these things in his own private life, and you have no idea. And there are all sorts of discussions in terms of families marrying into families they didn't know that were Sabbathian, and it's a whole, oh my, it's really, really crazy. However, let's just talk about a less extreme form, because when we talk about Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, this is more what we have to talk about. Even after Shabtai Tzvi died, I'll use as an example, once again, I don't want to name it, but like there's a sect that believe that their Rebbe is Mashiach. However, if you even speak to those people, what they have is they have different gradations of what they believe. So for example, there are many people who believe, and this is actually, there's a whole group of these people in Tzfat, in Eretz Yisrael, who believe that their Rebbe is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there's even a name for them. The term is called Elokistim. Every rabbi says you can't join with them with a minion. That is Avodah Zarah. So that's obviously very extreme. You end up with people that say that their Rebbe didn't die. Then you end up with a lower level. Then you end up with like people that say that he's coming back, which is a whole different discussion, which we'll discuss in just a moment also. And then you have easily the least extreme. So for me, this is something that doesn't bother me at all. I was one time at a wedding, and this person was telling me, he was saying, yeah, I believe that my Rebbe is Mashiach, but I believe that Mashiach is going to be the Gilgal of my Rebbe, which means it's going to be the reincarnation. So honestly, we've had such a long galut, I don't care. Like, I don't care. Just bring it on. talking about the 40-year thing, in 1666, that's when Shabtai's feet came out of the closet of sorts and said, I am Mashiach. There is a line in the Zohar that says, and I'm not going to get to authorship of the Zohar in the slightest, that says that Mashiach will hide himself for 40 years, and then he's going to come. There was a whole group of Sabavians who moved to Eretz Yisrael to be there in 1706, to be there for the 40-year anniversary, because they thought that Shabtai Tzvi was coming back to Eretz Yisrael to be Mashiach. To be Mashiach. Now they counted it from his apostasy, from him becoming Islam, from him becoming Muslim, as opposed to his actual death. What's fascinating about that, if you've ever been to the Horva Shul before, the Horva Shul was made by a person named Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. According to almost all scholars, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid was a secret Sabathian, and the whole reason he went to Eretz Yisrael and made that synagogue, even though he himself didn't make it, however he's the one that started the community, was in order to welcome Shabtai Tzvi 40 years after his apostasy. It's funny because if you go there, it's now beautiful, they rebuilt it, but there's like a very, very small sign that says, not what I said right now, not at all. You could understand why most people wouldn't want that to be said. So, Shabtai Tzvi is long dead, he's in the ground. On February 4th, like we mentioned before, 1751, Rav Yaakov Emden comes into his private shul and says that these amulets belong to Rav Yosef Naibishitz, and I've looked at these amulets, and these amulets are absolutely written by someone who believes in Shabtai Tzvi. Absolutely someone who believes in Shabtai Tzvi. In a period that we said that could be considered to be one of the greatest in all of Jewish history, the Vilna Gaon, the Pnei Yehoshua, the Chidah, the Ramchal, the Shagas Aryeh, some of the greatest rabbis in the entire world, Rav Yosef Naibishitz was head and shoulders above all of them. If you're going to go ahead and start casting aspersions against him, that means you are going to the very, very top. And Rav Yaakov Emden, he was a very interesting person, like we mentioned before. However, there were already signs to a certain degree, and there were already warnings to a certain degree, that Rav Yosef Naibishitz might have believed, once again, in a gradation way, that Shabtai Tzvi was Mashiach. Now, what do I mean about this? In 1725, Rav Yosef Naibishitz, he was the Av based in Prague. And in 1725, there was a person who was apprehended at the Polish border, and they found a whole bunch of Sabathian writings. One of the Sfarim was called Ve'avo Hayom El Hamayim, that I'm going to come to the water. Water is very important in terms of Shabtai Tzvi, hence the Dun Med, they go out to the water every Tisha B'Av. It was assumed in 1725 that who was the author of this Sabathian tract? It was Rav Yosef Naibishitz. Now, at the time, Rav Yosef Naibishitz said, I did not write it. And he said, cursed is anyone who follows Shabtai Tzvi. However, this was taken so seriously by the Jewish community in Prague that they never, ever, ever appointed him as a chief rabbi. Because they said, we can't have a chief rabbi who even has rumors about him that he is a Sabathian. So he ends up moving over to Metz after being rejected as the Rav of Prague, and he never becomes the Rav of Prague. As we're going to see, it's going to be very important when we talk about the Nodeb Yehuda. Man, this has gone by way too fast for me. Oh my. There are other issues also. Rav Yosef Naibishitz had a son. His son's name was Wolf. Wolf Naibishitz becomes one of the biggest Sabathian prophets. Yes, yes. It's really shocking. So there's one letter by the Nodeb Yehuda to Rav Yosef Naibishitz. There's a letter to him that says, what's the deal with your son? So he writes, my son, what could I say? I can't figure it out. Like when I was younger, I used to I can't believe it. Child rearing, it must be so easy. Now that I have three kids, it's like, oh my gosh. As long as they're okay. Like that's just what it comes down to. So what happens is, rumors and allegations, there is most certainly where there's smoke, there's fire. So many people said that Wolf Naibishitz was a Sabathian prophet, not because of his own feelings, but because his own father was a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. There are other issues also. One of the people who Rav Yosef Naibishitz was extremely close to was a person named Lebel Prusnitz. Lebel Prusnitz was, in the period before this whole thing comes out, he was the biggest Sabathian prophet. he was one of the biggest ones, along with another person named, I forgot, Hayun, I think his name is. They were the two biggest Sabbathean prophets. So already that becomes a big problem. There's also all sorts of other issues. There's a person named Label Soref, who's also a Sabbathean prophet, who spends time at Jonas and Ibishes' house. So that becomes very problematic. So there's definitely what to be said. However, as is brought down so beautifully by this amazing author, and I'll give this to you guys if you guys want it. Totally. I forgot where I put it. Oh, yeah, it's over here. By this person, Pavel Majeko. He says in 1725, nothing really happened. 1725, okay, so he doesn't become chief rabbi of Prague. He's able to move on to Metz, and he's able to later on move on to the very, very prestigious rabbinate of Hamburg, Wandsbek, and Altona. He becomes the rabbi of them. So obviously it wasn't that crazy. But what's the difference between 1725 and between 1751? So according to this author, he says a lot of this has to do with the press. A lot of this has to do with the non-Jewish press. So let us move and see a little bit of this, because this is what I gave you guys over here, and this is the non-Torah that we're going to learn tonight, which is very, I find this to be fascinating. So, the Emden Ibishes controversy. Let's take a look just at source number one. This is from a Polish newspaper called the Courier Polski, 1751. From Hamburg, the 16th of June. A great controversy erupted between the Jews and Altona. It was caused by their rabbi or sage, who is convinced that the Messiah has already come. One half of the Jews accepted this teaching, and the other half remains in their mistakes, from which great quarrel and hatred among these Jews, and further events will soon be revealed. Oh my, the non-Jewish press. This is the first time in the Polish press that they quote anything having to do with Judaism. The only other times that Jews are mentioned within the last 100 years of this newspaper are 4 times when Jews convert to Christianity. This is the very first time that there's intra-Jewish affairs. They're now being broadcast to everybody. Each rabbi marshals support. Each rabbi takes support. Now, it's very easy for Rav Yosef Eibishtis to get support, because almost all of the rabbis in Europe are his students and his friends and people that he's very, very close to. So they all sign all sorts of messages of support to him, and they actually put everyone who follows Rav Yaakov Emden, they put everyone into cherem. What does cherem mean? Cherem means that you can't daven with them, they can't be part of a community, they can't have a Jewish burial, they are not part of a Jewish community. Rav Yaakov Emden, he was the son of the Chacham Tzvi, he comes from one of the most prestigious rabbinic communities in the entire world, and he gets his family members to support him. So he happens to have a cousin in Amsterdam named Rav Aryeh Leib, who's one of the biggest rabbis in the entire world. Rav Aryeh Leib says, no, Rav Yosef Eibishtis is a Sabbathean. Another example of someone who ended up losing his leadership in Frankfurt. There was a great rabbi named the Pnei Yehoshua, Rav Yehoshua Falk. Amazing rabbi. We learn his Sfarim. For some reason, our base medrash happens to have 4 sets of the Pnei Yehoshua. It's very interesting. It's the only one that there's just 4 sets of the Pnei Yehoshua. So Pnei Yehoshua lost his job in Frankfurt because he supported Rav Yaakov Emden against Rav Yosef Eibishtis. A lot of personal tolls that he took on this. Number two, this is from a German newspaper. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm going to mispronounce this first one. I'm so sorry. Gattingsche Zeitung. I don't know what the first... Zeitung, thank you so... I'm so sorry, I apologize. Oh my, my mom's Ashkenazi, yeah, but you know how it is. 1752. We must suspend the judgment that we cannot say if the rabbi of Metz, who so far has made so great an oppression, held the impostor Shabtai Tzvi from Messiah or not. For the testimonies provided by both sides do not allow the Christian authorities to solve this issue short of undertaking a direct investigation at local level. We can only say that with certainty that among the defenders of the rabbi of Metz, there are some Jews also known to us who for certain are not the followers of Shabtai Tzvi, and the Jewish authorities cannot deny it. So we have over here people now this is all over the media. Non-Jews care about this also. In Hamburg, on the floor of the stock exchange, there's an actual fist fight between Jewish people. Some people fighting for Rav Yaakov Emden, some people fighting four Rav Yonos and Ivashits fighting each other on the floor of the stock exchange. And this makes international news. Everyone is reading about this. Now, there's also other issues where, for example, many of the Tovei Ha'ir, those people that were very wealthy, they supported Rav Yonos and Ivashits. So there is somewhat to be said about that, that like part of Rav Yaakov Emden is that he was very much a rabble-rouser. He was somebody who, he says about himself in Megillah Sefer, he says, I did not leave my house for 20 years. For 20 years. He says he never ever left his house. He had his own minyan in his house. I mean, once again, I'm not going to play, you know, therapist, but like, it sounds like agoraphobia. But he had a printing press in his house, and he really printed a ton. He printed so much against Shabtai Tzvi. However, he was really his worst enemy, as we'll get to in just a couple minutes. So, Rav Yonos and Ivashits, he happened to have a student. Whenever you have 20,000 students, you're going to have some students who end up not becoming, Yireim V'Shleimim. And one of those people happens to be, in source number 3, his name is Carl Antone. In 1752, now remember, Rav Yonos and Ivashits took over the chief rabbi of Altona, which the Chacham Tzvi had before, and Rav Yaakov Emden did not get. He did not become the rabbi of Altona, even though that's where he was born, and that's where his father was the chief rabbi of. He did not become the chief rabbi. Instead, they hired Rav Yonos and Ivashits. So there is people that say that he was very jealous of Rav Yonos and Ivashits, so that's why he came up with all of this stuff against Rav Yonos and Ivashits. However, this person, Carl Antone, he comes to defend Rav Yonos and Ivashits, but there's a major problem. He used to be religious. He learned in the yeshiva of Rav Yonos and Ivashits, but eventually he becomes a convert to Christianity. He becomes a convert to Christianity. So you definitely don't want a defender like this, as you're going to see, really badly. So if you take a look at source A, he writes in 1752, "Dear reader, I was asked by many who from newspapers," once again you see how important newspapers are at this period, "and other news learned about the momentous movement that so violently divided Hamburg and Altona Jewry, what this unrest was about. As I was already very well informed about this controversy, I could give an exact and helpful answer to those who were curious about the essence of the issue." Take a look at source 3.3b. "I hold my current religion, Christianity, condition and profession in too high an opinion to deal with such people as my opponent," because people wrote against him, "or with Jews at all. God's plain word is not enough for these people, and they spread heresy and curse us who believe in Jesus, Son of Mary, the true Messiah." If you take a look at source C, you always have these self-hating Jews. These are always the worst ones for Judaism. "Jewish silver pieces have the power to force the greatest scholars to write what the Jews want, and the power of the Jews is great, and their might is frightening." And this over here, source D, Rav Yaakov Emden said about Rav Yonos and Ivashits, he said he didn't just think he was a crypto-Sabathian, he said that he actually believed he was really a Christian. He was a secret Christian. And we have over here, from Carl Antone, in source D, in 3D, "I first read the idea that Rabbi Jonathan is a clandestine Christian in these newspapers. My heart moved when I heard this. Oh, how I wish it was true. But it is no more than a newspaper fable, and my joy is badly timed. If Rabbi Jonathan really were a hidden Christian, for the audacious Jews and the impudent Pharisees, it would be so similar to heresy, and they would describe him in public newspapers as a heretic, even if his errors were pardoned." You definitely don't want a defender like this, because the very next line, which I didn't bring for you guys because it's actually quite lengthy, he writes that, you know what, maybe it is true, but we shouldn't hit the hornet's nest. We shouldn't try to get him out of, you know, his secrecy. We shouldn't be the ones to force him. Let Rav Yonasan come out as a Christian publicly himself, and let's not force him to do it. Oh my. So what exactly is going on? There's so much going on, and tonight we've already spoken for 1 hour and 5 minutes, and we've barely even touched the surface. So tonight I want to just leave you guys with three different mahalchim, that three different methods that three great rabbis used against Rav Yonos and Ivashits, and how it worked out, and one final story, hopefully of inspiration. Because this is not inspiring tonight. Oh my, it's like really sad. So Dr. Sherry Lyman has three amazing monographs. One he has on the Vilna Gaon's idea about whether or not Rav Yonos and Ivashits was a Sabbathean. He was only 26 at the time when the entire thing came out. That just goes to show how important the Vilna Gaon was. He also has a whole thing about the Pnei Yehoshua, all about the Pnei Yehoshua's methodology, and he has a whole thing about the Nebi Yehuda. So he has three different approaches. He calls them three different ways. Number one, it's the Emden approach. The Emden approach is the scorched earth approach. He says we're going to totally level Rabbi Yosef and Eibeshitz. We're going to use whatever method possible, publish missives against them, appeal to the government, speak to everybody, garner support from everywhere, and get Rabbi Yosef and Eibeshitz out of being chief rabbi of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. Get him out of this. He can't be. How dare we have anyone who's so duplicitous? How could we have anyone that is a chief rabbi but also believes in Shabtai Tzvi? He says there's absolutely no way to rehab. There's no way to fix someone who believes in this heresy. So he will not take any solution aside from getting Rav Yosef and Eibeshitz out of his position. However, the biggest problem with this is that Rav Yaakov Emden, as great as he was, in this regard, he was his worst enemy. He was his worst enemy. Because he was so honest about everything, he writes certain things that you also have to take very much with a grain of salt. So for example, he calls Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz an Am Haaretz. No one in their right mind, even those people that believed, as we'll see in just a moment, even those people that believed Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz was a Sabbathian, they say absolutely he was one of the biggest Talmidei Chachamim, he was one of the biggest rabbis in the entire world. That is not up for debate. Not up for debate at all. The other thing he says he's, Rav Yaakov Emden says about himself, he says, I'm a better public speaker than Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz. That also was problematic. It was that Rav Yonis and Eibeshitz was known throughout all of Europe as such an amazing orator. So that obviously wasn't true. And, people didn't really take what he was writing seriously, which is really interesting, because about most things, he happens to be right, which is really interesting. About those personal opinions, he's very wrong, but about many things, he's right. I'll just discuss that in just a moment, if you'll just allow me, because this is important. As I mentioned before, he did not leave his house for 20 years, which means he was reliant on other people to bring him information about Rav Yosef and Eibeshitz. So Dr. Lyman has a beautiful essay. It's called A Grave Matter Indeed, where Rav Yaakov Emden publishes that within Rav Yosef and Eibeshitz's wife's kever, on her tombstone, it says clearly, Shabtai Tzvi in big letters. It's an acrostic for Shabtai Tzvi. And he writes this during the time that anyone could walk over to Hamburg and look at this, look at the tombstone and see it. And he writes it as if it's truth. However, if you take a look at the tombstone, it doesn't say that at all. What happens is that unfortunately a student had rejiggered and put big letters where small letters should have been and put it in where it looked very, very much according to the writing that it was like that it said Shabtai Tzvi. But if you look at the actual tombstone, it doesn't at all spell out Shabtai Tzvi. So already Rav Yaakov Emden is losing out on credibility by publishing stuff that really he didn't check out on because he really wasn't able. So that's what happens. However, if you're going to credit anyone, with stamping out the Sabbathean heresy, you have to give it to Rav Yaakov Emden. Because he most certainly goes ahead and does this, and he is the one to get rid of it. Because it was something that was, I hate to say this, it was somewhat normal. So for example, I happen to have a sefer over here. It's called Kitzur Shnei Luchot Habrit. It's written by a fellow named Epstein. He was known to be a known Sabbathean, but yet he's writing all about the Shlah. This is something you could find in any Beit Midrash. You could find this a totally normal sefer. However, at the very end, there's all sorts of ideas which seem to, according to most scholars, which seem to reference Shabtai Tzvi, which is really interesting. That's the first approach. It's the scorched earth policy. There was another great rabbi. In fact, we even have someone in our community. We have two people in our community. There's Harold Landa, Dr. Landa, and there's also Dr. Evan Landau. They both are inuklach of the Nodeb Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau. Cheska Landau was younger than Rabbi Yosef Eibeshitz at the time. However, he was known to be a rabbinic star. He was incredible. He started off in a place called Yampol, which you would say, is like a one street light town, and he becomes the chief rabbi of Prague. And he writes amazing Svarim. He writes the Navi Yehuda. He writes the Slach. He was one of the biggest rabbis in the entire world. He was tremendous. So what he wanted to do is that he saw the future beautifully. He said, I know what's going to happen. This is going to be a tremendous Chilul Hashem. We have the biggest rabbi in the world being called a Sabbathian. How could we make this go away? So he has an idea. He says, all Rav Yonasan Eibishitz has to do is get up, denounce Shabtai Tzvi, and never write another Kameya again. Never write another amulet again. All amulets in circulation must be brought to him and must be destroyed. That is on the condition that Rav Yonasan Eibishitz will remain the rabbi of Altona. So what are you in essence doing? You're taking away all of the Sabbathian feelings and keeping the Torah, the tremendous Torah. And I would say in the yeshivish world, that's exactly what happened. And he succeeded in this regard because Rav Yonasan Eibishitz is, and rightly so, known to be one of the biggest rabbis in our entire Mesorah. What's interesting is that both sides claimed Rav Yecheskel Landau, both sides claimed him to be pro them. So for example, Rav Yonasan Eibishitz writes, he says, of course I'm not a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. Then Rav Yehuda doesn't believe that I'm a follower of Shabtai Tzvi. He writes this. Rav Yaakov Emden at first is very enamored by the Rebbe Yehuda and really loves him and says, of course he thinks Rav Yonasan Eibishitz is a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. However, later on, when Rav Yecheskel Landau comes up with this approach, which involves keeping Rav Yonasan Eibishitz as a chief rabbi, he ends up saying that the Rebbe Yehuda is a secret Sabbathian. Now, one thing that is not true, he was most certainly not a secret Sabbathian. But this is where awesome stuff happens. Oh my gosh, and this is why I love history. In 1877, there was published a letter which had never been published before. What it was is that it was a letter from Rav Yonasan Eibishitz to Maria Teresa, who was in charge at the time of Prague. And the letter says, even though I left for Metz, which at the time was an enemy combatant during the war of Austrian secession. Even though I left and went to the enemy side, I still want to come back to Prague and I want to live out my final years in my original hometown. So, Maria Teresa appeals to the Chief Rabbi of Prague. And who is the Chief Rabbi of Prague? The Rebbe Yehuda. We have a letter signed by the Rebbe Yehuda that says, and I will read it for you in here, it's a devastating letter which states unequivocally that Eibishitz was a Sabbathian, and that he had been placed under the ban by the leading rabbis in Germany and Italy, and that Jewish law prohibits Landau and Eibishitz from residing together in the same city. The letter bears Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, Rav Yecheskel Landau, it bears his signature. This was the letter he wrote to Maria Teresa, and Maria Teresa writes Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, sorry, you can't come to Prague. And that's exactly why Rav Yonasan Eibishitz ends up dying in Altona. So we have over here evidence, documentary evidence. Now there's a whole question whether or not for years they believed this was fake. Because this was actually first published by Heinrich Graetz. And there's a lot of people, Graetz was interesting, but there's a lot of issues with it. However, Dr. Lyman has found so much evidence to show that it is most certainly authentic. And that really, Rav Yecheskel Landau did believe that Rav Yonasan Eibishitz was a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi. That's very interesting. The last approach we have is the Fock approach. This is the Pnei Yehoshua approach. He had a whole idea where he said, let's bring Rav Yonasan Eibishitz to a Din Torah. Let's bring him to a Beit Din. That would be the easiest way possible. If he's exonerated by the Beit Din, then all's good and well. He can go back. But yet if the Beit Din finds that he really is a secret follower of Shabtai Tzvi, then obviously he'll leave. This most certainly didn't work, because what happened was the Pnei Yehoshua was one of the biggest rabbis at the time. He's writing letter after letter after letter to Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, telling him, come to a Din Torah. Rav Yonasan Eibishitz again and again and again refuses, and he doesn't even answer back. He says, I don't need to answer to you. And that's exactly what happens. And as we mentioned before, he actually ends up losing his job to Bnei Yehoshua. And he has to leave Frankfurt because of all of the stuff going on with Shabtai Tzvi, with this whole Emden Eibeshitz fight. So how exactly would we end this like on a quasi-high note? How do we do this? I know. So all I've done for you guys today is given you a little bit of background about Shabtai Tzvi. There's so much more, and honestly, we're only scratching the very top. I've given you different evidence to show whether or not Rabbi Yossi Eibeshitz was a Sabbathean or not, even though multiple times he came out and said that he was not a Sabbathean. What's interesting is he wrote an entire tract where he said that he's not Sabbathean. However, what's interesting is that many people read it and said, even within his denial, he's showing that he's a secret Sabbathean, which is a whole different discussion. We saw three different approaches. We saw the approach of Rav Yaakov Emden, the scorched earth approach. We saw the rehabilitation approach by Rav Yechezkel Landau, by the Navi Yehuda. And we saw the Falk approach, which is trying to isolate him, and that does not end up working and ends up blowing back in the Bnei Yehoshua's face. So this is the story that they tell. The story that they tell is that when Rav Yaakov Emden passed away in 1776, he was on his deathbed. And what happens is he calls out. He says, Abba, his Abba is the Chacham Tzvi. He says, Abba, it's nice to see you again. What's the next line he says? He says, Rav Yonasan, good to see you. Which is crazy. What happens is when the Chevra Kedisha had a choice of where to put Rav Yaakov Emden. Because remember, what happened was, oh, I didn't tell you guys this before. What happened was, sorry about this. Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz had passed away in 1756. I don't remember. I have it exactly over here. I'm sorry. Yeah, he passed away in, sorry, not great for the recording, 1764. He passed away in 1764. So 12 years later, Rav Yaakov Emden would pass away, and he says this to, supposedly on his deathbed, he says, Rav Yonasan, hello. At this time, there was only one plot left in the Altona, in the Altona Hamburg Wandsbek Cemetery. There's only one left. And where is this plot? It happens to be within the same row as Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, the person who he fought with his entire life. And it just so happened at that very, very time, the Nodeb Yehuda was traveling by. And they asked them, the town asked them, they said, should we bury Rav Yaakov Emden next to his adversary? So Nodeb Yehuda said, since this story about saying hi Rav Yonasan, it shows that in the Olam HaEmet, they're working out well together. And if you actually go to Altona today, you will see they're about five graves away in the same row. You'll find on the left Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, and on the right you'll find Rav Yaakov Emden. So this is a fight that there's still evidence coming out. Oh, there's one last thing. I apologize. The last thing, oh my gosh. So this is like the best. Okay, we're not ending on a good part. Sorry about this. We're not ending. We're ending on like a very interesting part. Guys, everyone turn to source 4. Because source 4, this person, David Friedrich Mergelin, what he does is that he shows why was Christian interest so strong? Why did they care so much about this fight, this internal strife between Shabtai, between a follower supposedly of Shabtai Tzvi and between Rav Yaakov Emden? So he says over here, the issue at hand is not simply trade and amulets. It is not about finding a justification for the empty Kabbalistic play with words and symbols. The controversy should not be seen as an inflated fantasy or childish play. It is not, as many claim, about serious espousal of the Sabbathean heresy and so on. What is attacked here is the very substance of the Christian faith. Since the Holy Trinity, the name of the true Messiah, Yeshu, and the honor of his worship, together with their pawn, build Christian creed and divine worship. The Father, together with the Son and the Spirit, so beautifully exposed in the Zohar Kabbalah, is presented as impure, ungodly, heretical, profaned, even deserving to be burned. So they burn the amulets and claim they do not deserve anything but being burned, for they contain the vain and empty name of Shabtai Tzvi. If only we drop these two words, Shabtai Tzvi, the entire controversy will become clear. If we explain the unbelievable expressions in the amulets according to Christian teachings, everything would fall into place. It would appear that this Rabbi Jonathan is a clandestine Christian and that he had declared his faith in written form of 26 amulets disseminated all over Europe. The reason why it was such an international cause celebrity amongst the Christians, because they said, if we could take upon ourselves Rav Yonasan, if we could claim him to be a Christian believer, oh my, think about how many converts we would get then. Have a fantastic night.
Thank you.
Oh my.
Thank you so much.
Oh, oh my. Oh my. I didn't even touch.
I know.
They're so oh my. I like prepared way too much. Anything.
I started breathing.
Will there be a class next week on Hanukkah?
You don't know. I'll have to call the other
service. Okay, thank you. Wonderful.
What would be a good book to read about established Jews in Spain, 1492? I started trying to understand that to go back, because the first Jews to America were escaping the Inquisition from Brazil.
Yes.
They were part of that whole thing.
Oh my, of course.
Yeah.
1654.
Yeah.
Sheretz Israel.
Exactly.
Yes.
They were coming from Brazil.
Oh,
right. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So the best book about that that I know of is that Bibi Netanyahu's father has a whole set of books. One of them is ginormous, called The Spanish Inquisition. So he goes way into this.
What's his first name?
His name is... Yeah, it's on Amazon. I think his name is... I totally forgot. I'm blanking out. I have it in my house. So yeah, there's that, but then he has another one on the Moran. Fascinating.
Where were you? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. It's like there's a lot there.
That's what I'm...
He's the best. Everything I took from him, I'm telling you. He's amazing. He's my Rebbe. I love him.
Great.
Fantastic.
Oh, what an energy. God bless him.
I'm not familiar with him. If it would be anywhere... No, I wasn't. I'm telling you. I'm telling you. There's so, no, but it's so bad. Like I said in the beginning, like, it's the best explanation I can give according to those people that he was speaking. How do you say that word? His great grandfather was a guy. Probably Catholic. No. Yeah, he's named after Mark. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming. Oh my, thank you. He said regards to Eitan. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. Oh, this is excellent. Leiman. If you just go online, you type in Leiman Library, he actually took the cup all of the stuff that you want. This, oh my gosh, is so much. This is amazing. Oh my gosh, thanks. Just email me, I'll send you over.
What's your email?
Oh my, please. Oh my, thank
you. You sure you
don't? Oh, please. I don't. Trust me, I have so many copies of these. I have the originals also.
Yes.
He's amazing. He'll pull out something. He'll be like, there's only two copies. One is in the JTS library, the other one I'm holding in my hand. But he's been doing a lot of research about Belushin. He has a thing where he discovered that Belushin was actually closed in 1850s. It worked so well because it's a famous story with a lion all down. I would bribe somebody, a Russian official. It was officially closed. And what happened was that, like, this famous story where this one guy comes, and the former guy had died, and this new guy comes, and he's like expecting to see nothing there. And he comes there, and he sees a yeshiva with 400 students. He's like, what's going on here? And they try bribing him, and he says, no way. He's like, I'm going to throw the book at him. The legend was a very long trip back. So he stayed the night. So the story they tell is that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, he put on a winter jacket. It was the dead of summer. Put on a winter jacket. And he started walking around. And what happened was, is that this Russian guy, he's like, yo, what are you doing? He says, I had a dream that's going to snow. So he said, you're crazy, Reb Chaim. They say you're smart, but you're crazy. He says, you want to bet? I bet you $100 it's going to snow tonight.
So what happens is, the next morning, obviously, as we snow, the guy comes over to collect the money. At that time, Rufayim said, yeah, you want to take this bribe? He took the bribe. And the whole idea is this, is that, like, once already someone gets something that really shouldn't belong to them, then therefore they'll be way more amenable to taking bribes. But, like, I always heard that story, and I'm like, oh, wait, like, none of that makes sense. Because, like, why is this happening? Like, what's going on with these bribings and stuff like that? But Dr. Lang explains it. Because officially, the yeshiva was shut down for all intents and purposes according to the Russian government. But that's a whole
a different method.
That is something totally, that's later. This is during the 1850s. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that is, that's because, that's what Dr. Lyman sees of it, which is amazing. I know. They didn't want any Jews. So they closed the entire thing. They shut it down. Yeah, exactly. So they had this one guy who was enriching himself from being the inspector. Nothing going on over there.
The second Rabbi Landau suggested that all the ambulances be collected and destroyed. That was never actually done.
No, that was done. Rabbi Yonasan said that he was going to do it. We have. Because all these rabbis got involved, I couldn't even talk about this. Bnei Yeshua asked for copies of the amulets. And we have amulets that have, that are, I'm forgetting what the term is called, where you have a person there who signs. A notary. We have notarized amulets, the exact amulets that were brought to Rav Yaakov Emden. We have these amulets that were brought. Even Rav Chaim Landau says, he says, okay, they're from the Yosef. So I don't think that they're Sabathian, I'm not sure. But if you wouldn't have told me who it was, I would for sure said it was Sabathian.
So
that's okay.
Amulets, yeah, but we do have these, like, copies of them, which are according to everybody. Dr. Lyman writes in this article.
I think I gave it to
Oh, yes, please. Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very,
no, thank
very
you
much.
So much. I'm
it
so
was
sorry.
Fascinating.
Oh my. It's YOSEF.
YOSEF.
At HillelIsrael.org. Yeah. For sure. .org. All my students write .com. And they're like, Rabbi, you didn't get my test. I'm like, not YOSEF.
Okay.
Oh my.
YOSEF at HillelIsrael.org. Or Yosef at HillelDS for dayschool.org.
DS?
Well, he said DS. Yes, day school.
Oh, .org.
Yes. Right. He was phenomenal.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, I've never heard him before. He was really good. Okay, shall we go?
I must have asked him today if he knew Eitan Buehler. Because he just said to me,
oh,
you look like him. I said, no, he looks like me.
Wow, okay. I still want to run over to...
Yes, there is. Oh, my God. There's so much stuff to talk about.
About 50, over 50.
Yes. Thessalonica.
Yeah. No,
because there were 15,000 in World War I in Salonika, yeah, but I think there were 50,000 in the Balkans.
In the Turkish Empire.
Oh, my.
In Turkey today, there are, they say, about 50,000.
That's crazy. There's a group in Washington, D.C. They say they're done men. It's fascinating.
And by the way, would you say about France?
Yes.
They say Louis Brandes.
Yes, yes, his
mother.
He kept a picture of Eva Frank.
His mother had a picture of Frank.
Yes. Oh my God, I'm sorry, I get so excited. Oh my God, yes. They say on top of his dresser. It's in his biography.
His mother.
Oh my.
They were Frankish.
Yes, yes, oh my gosh. It's amazing. Oh my. Oh my.
Do you have a bill by Netanyahu?
I do have it in Israel.
Oh.
I have like half, it's crazy. I have my wife is like very upset at me. Because like, like, I don't know. It's hilarious. So my kids like eat next to books, like sleep next to books. Like I just got my father-in-law just brought from New York. My father-in-law just came down. He brought an entire trunk just full of sperm for me. I'm telling you, I'm like to water. I'm like,
oh, you're down, they're
oh
down
my
here
gosh,
now.
Yeah.
Here for the winter.
They're down here for the whole winter. Very I'm so nice. Excited. I told him not to come tonight because I'd be too embarrassed. My in-laws. I love my in-laws.
Where are they from?
They're from Edison, New Jersey. Oh, same great place. Oh my. Yeah, I mean, I love Edison. Whenever I go up there, I speak in the shul over there. So, yeah. And Rabbi Luban. I don't know if you know Rabbi Luban.
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. He's
excellent.
You got to speak for
my
son-in-law.
Oh, no. Chas v'shalom. Your son-in-law is the greatest. I couldn't even, like... I can't even, like, reach up to, like, the dust that's beneath his toes. I'm telling you, he's incredible. I'm serious.
You
oh, my gosh.
You Garden Hills?
Yes. I used to
that's
say...
That's where I'm from.
So you know Dr. Lyman very well, right? Oh, my gosh. He's the best. And Dr. Berger, right? Oh, my gosh. Whenever Dr. Berger comes down here, because I teach the
He used to live on my corner.
Oh, my gosh. Incredible. And Dr. Schatz.
I used to live there, too.
Dr. Schatz.
Oh, I love Dr. Schatz. Oh, yeah. My.
He now lives in West Hempstead.
Oh, my gosh. These are all... So yeah. When my wife and I, we have these amazing memories, because it's like a secret... I think I actually just deleted it. He's having a shiur this upcoming Friday night.
Who?
I get Dr.
Schatz.
Lyman.
Oh.
Dr. Lyman. Like
my son goes over every Friday.
I get... Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my. I can't...
No, I'm in Deerfield now.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. I think I deleted it. Yeah, I deleted it. Because I get these emails. I shouldn't have deleted it. I get these emails which are saying, oh, yeah, he's speaking this upcoming Friday night. I don't have it in here.
Wait, here?
No. In Kew Garden Hills. Because I still get the emails. Because I was on the...
It's Friday night. Friday night.
Exactly. The personal email list. So I wish, because for my wife and I... Because my wife's not so into Jewish history. Which is, like, hilarious. She's more into, like, normal Torah. Like, she thinks I'm a little bit crazy. In terms of, like, this kind of stuff. Like, having an interest in it.
Definitely not crazy.
But, like, this last thing over here. This is a collector's item.
You can look at that book when she finishes it.
Oh my gosh, but J.J. Sheffy never finished writing Migos Sefer.
You don't know Spanish.
No. My dad speaks Spanish. What's it called? My mom's Ashkenazia, so what happened was, this has been recorded, the whole thing. Oh, this is hilarious. Oh my, yeah, nothing bad, don't worry. Yeah, off. How does it turn off?
I never know.